this evening, first I'd like to talk about selfing and then about love and feelings, various feelings. But why do I want to talk about selfing? Because I think this is something interesting in a way to look at how we create, in a way, a sense of self, an experience of self, in the way we describe it to ourselves. I think it can be interesting to notice how we build it, how we create it, what we do, in a way, with that sense of self, which is happening, again, according to inner and outer conditions. Because it seems to me that there is what I could call a positive selfing. And for me, very much, in a way, the way of meditation, the way of the Buddha, is very clearly a positive selfing, creating, in a way, a wise, compassionate self, which is skillful, which is creative, in a way. But it seems also that we can have a tendency to get caught in what I would call negative selfing, which often really fixes us, limits our potential, reduces us. But in a way, one could say the first way we seem to experience self is in a strange way, often, possibly not everybody, but a lot of people, or possibly most people, have this impression that they are the center of the universe. So whatever somebody does is because of me. Or even if it rains, is because of me, or it's to annoy me. It's kind of like we feel we are the center of the universe. The problem is that everybody feels they are the center of the universe. So you have all the center of the universe kind of going round. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. Actually, this is very interesting, because this can come out in this very heightened, and I think that's where you really feel the sense, when you are very self-conscious. You know, suddenly everybody look at you, and you think, ooh, you kind of really feel a very self-sense. You know, one can get, and often in silence too, it looks like if you read together in silence, often you can get very self-conscious, you know, kind of, are they looking at me eating my soup in a funny way, or whatever it is, very interesting. This feeling of the self will come out. And, of course, I would say we are the center of our universe, not the center of the universe, of course. And if we don't take care of ourselves, nobody else will. But I think, in a way, to try to dissolve a little this idea that I am the center of the universe. I think in a way to try to work with it. How does it manifest? How can I deal with it, maybe in a lighter way? And I think also one way it manifests is the feeling we have that we are special. I am special. I must do something special. I have a special place in the universe. And, I mean, I could see this in myself very early on. You know, I mean, 11 years old, I was thinking I wanted to be the president of the republic, you know, to save the world again. And then I thought, well, maybe this is a bit kind of complicated. Maybe I can just be like, you know, in the parliament. And then I thought, oh, that can be complicated. So I kind of downgraded again and again. But I remember once working in England, in a post office, and somebody saying to me, I mean, I was 18, saying to me, oh, you always want to be special. So obviously, in some way, I manifested this kind of, you know, wanting to be special. And then I became a nun in Korea. And I was one first nun in Korea. among 60 million people. That is special. And also one French man for another 60 million people in France. I mean, that is special. And then I stopped doing the nun. And what was really interesting was at the beginning of not being a nun anymore, and I wore ordinary clothes, and I felt, why is nobody looking at me? Nobody is looking at me. Nobody is looking at me specially. I am just like anybody else. And it was very interesting, that feeling, you know, of that feeling of wanting to be special. It was very interesting, very interesting. And then since then, in a way, I think I have discovered, I have enjoyed being ordinary. And to be listening in the way, actually, the part of the meditation process is actually learning to enjoy and appreciate that we are really ordinary. But that there is beauty in this ordinariness. And that's why, in a way, I rejoice in just being more and more ordinary and not being special anymore. And to me, this is very interesting how it has manifested in my life in many different ways. And also in the way my life has gone in reverse of the Buddha. You know, I started as a nun, then I was living in a community of Buddhists, you know, very special again, very Buddhist. And now I live in France, in this little village, and there is no Buddhist within 60 kilometers. Nobody knows about us. And I am just a daughter of my mother, who knows everybody in the village. But I'm just a daughter. And it's very interesting, because it really makes me much more aware of the ordinary life, of the ordinary people. And I find that, again, that's a way to connect, to have connection with people, to be compassionate, to be concerned. So this is about this being special in a way, looking a little plain with it. Of course, as somebody said once I talk about this, you are special to your mother. It's still there, don't worry. So in terms of the selfing, I am not going to talk about patterns and tendency, because this is a big subject, and if I ever come back to Israel, then I can really talk about patterns and tendency, but then we will try. But what is interesting in terms of selfing is, in a way, how we stick. You know, what is interesting is how we limit our sense of self. How do we do that? And as I mentioned it already, is that, in a way, I feel, through the meditation, we see how we are this flow of conditions meeting the outer world. And so there is many conditions. And for me, the meditation is a discovery of the multiplicity of our conditions. But I think a lot of the time we are suffering because we fix ourselves in one condition. We can fix ourselves in just one thought. Something happens and we have a thought. And in a way we define ourselves, we identify ourselves with a thought. Some time ago, as I was working on a book, I did a maneuver on the computer. For 15 days, I had done something to work on my book, correction. I corrected the whole manuscript. And then I did something on the computer. I am not very computer literate. And the correction went forever, not to be retrieved. And I could see the first inclination was, I am stupid. I'm so stupid. I am always stupid. And how I could kind of, in a way, fix and fix more and more myself in this thought, I am stupid. And then I thought, no, this was a stupid thing to do. This was a mistake, but at least I have learned not to do it again. And straight away, there was much more enlightenment. And I could, you know, start again with the correction and whatever. So you see, when we fix ourselves, then in a way there is no movement. If we don't fix, then in a way they can. The movement of the flow of condition can continue. Or you could, in a way, get caught, fixed in just one sensation, one emotion, like anger, like sadness. And to see, like to me, that's what the feeling I was trying to make you kind of look at today, was to see that we are not just one emotion. We cannot, even if we have certain tendencies, we cannot identify ourselves with an emotion. We cannot say, I am an angry person. I am a sad person. Often, you can say, I have a tendency to have these emotions. But you are not just that emotion. Because you cannot always be angry. You cannot always be sad. It's very hard to sustain one emotion, one feeling for a long time. Of course, it can come up and go down, come up and go down. But we cannot just be one thing. This is really very, very essential to see. But we can have a feeling of sadness because something happened. When my father died, I was very sad. But because it was a normal response to the condition. But you know what was quite interesting when my father died and when we had this funeral happening, is everybody does it. And we were sad, and then we would laugh. We were sad, and then we would laugh. Because you cannot just have one emotion all the time. There is death, but at the same time as there is death, life continues. This is in a way the thing. We're in the middle of this happening, death and life. And so we need to be careful when we fix ourselves in one emotion. Or we can fix ourselves in one physical attribute. And for example, myself, you may think that I am small. But I don't feel I am small. I feel I am tall. And it's only when I'm next to somebody who's taller than me that I feel, yes, I am not so tall. But because I am the tallest in my family, everybody is smaller than me, so I always feel, yeah, I'm tall. So to be careful how we can, again, identify ourselves. We want physical attributes. Another thing we can do is to fix in one quality. I am a good person. I am always good. Goodness comes upon conditions. And to me that's why it's so interesting to read sometimes the biography of great people we admire. I admire greatly Gandhi. Greatly. Ah, he was a terrible father. I mean, he was terrible. If you look at his life story in terms of family, it's very strange. Or if I read the book, which I think is very interesting, called Crooked Cucumber. It's a biography of a Sunil Suzuki. One of these very interesting guys, a very respected Zen master who wrote Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you would think he's a great Zen master and he's written Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and you know, you think, wow, he must be amazingly mindful. In his village, he is famous for being extremely mindless. And when people saw him, generally they had something ready to find his stuff, to find his train ticket, or whatever it was. He was very known for forgetting things everywhere. And many of the things that, in a way, when you read the biography, you see the whole human person. And they're not just one quality. Or if I look in terms of sometimes, some people feel, I am bad. I am a bad person. And everybody thinks they are a bad person. And doing what is the most tragic is when the person themselves believes, I am a bad person. And I saw something very moving when I was in South Africa some years ago. It was a program on TV about a woman who went into prison where there was gangs in order to do conflict resolution so that the gang's influence would kind of diminish. And she really did good work. It really worked. She really kind of, you know, really, her work was very powerful with this young man in those gangs. And we have one young man who was 22 years old. And he was a gang member. And I presume he thought, I am a bad person. I am a gang member. I am going to be a gang member for the whole of my life. So he tattooed on his face, fuck my mother. So he had this tattoo, which was a very strong statement of how he felt about himself, his mother, and the world, I think. But through doing the conflict resolution work, he realized that he was not just a bad person, but that actually he could be a good person. I mean, he really changed. I mean, he wanted to do things, you know, for other people, etc., etc. So in a way, he was something else than he thought he was. And then he was stuck. So that inside he was different, but on his face, you know, there was this terrible tattoo, which, you know, gave a different identity. And then fortunately, a surgeon saw the program and offered freely to take it out. So in a way, but to me that was interesting. But for me to see, we are not just one quality. Then in a way, what we do sometimes with the selfie is in a way feeling that there is here. Although it's a very special self. It's a self in danger. Other selves are going to get me. And I think often we build all these walls and then we look at other selves. Oh, you're the girl, but not too close, you know. I have to protect myself. And instead of seeing, but actually we feel, I would say, the better. When the wall grows, when we have a very different relationship, not a relationship of fear and self-protection, but a kind of an open, worthy sense of self, which can then really go into relationship. Which really can, is not so afraid of being taken advantage or whatever it is, but is in a way still stable enough and open enough that he or she can meet the other. And so that the rule can come down, there can be more this texture, there can be more this dialogue. And in terms of that, that's what I wanted to talk a little about love this evening. To me, this is very interesting. I think love is a very important quality to develop. I think one of the difficulties in Buddhism, in spiritual work sometimes, is that people think that non-grasping means non-attachment, means I cannot love anybody. This is this kind of this trance movement. When I think on the contrary, I think the meditation can help us to really develop what I would call creative, wise love. And I think, you know, love is very important to cultivate, to experience, because it has a special feel to it. When we feel we love something, we love someone, we feel warmth. We feel different. For example, myself, when it's very minor, but in France, I live in the southwest, so it's not very cold, and we have snow about once every 3 years. And so every time it snows, I am so happy. I love snow. I think, wow, great. And I feel warm and I feel light. I feel like I'm 10 years old. I'm really very light and happy. And this led me to think that, you know, in terms of the self, and in terms of the self-centeredness, we have a little problem. But we're really self-centered. We really focus on ourselves, but for some strange reason, we don't like ourselves. So we focus on somebody we don't like. and to offer a lot of tension and conflict. But what if we loved ourselves? Then we would feel this lightness, this happiness all the time, because I am here all the time. I don't need to have another object to help me to feel better. I am here. And so in a way to see that in love there is also not only the love of the other, but I think it is very important, that aspect of loving oneself. Because I think if we really open love and accept ourselves, then actually I think it helps us to become lighter, to become more kind of, I think, creative, light. In the same way, if you like the snow, whatever it is you like, to see that's what it brings to us. And so I would say that love is an opening of the heart. It's a caring, it's an appreciation, and it is a relationship. When we love, that would be ourselves, others, whatever it is, we are in relationship with something that we love, that we appreciate. And I think this is very essential for the human being to develop, to grow, to be nurtured. And I could really see this with my grandmother. There was kind of a ritual I used to have with my grandmother, who was 92, was that whenever I came back, because I travel a lot, I am here now, and when I would come back from my travel, there was always a moment when I would come back, I would enter the room, and I would say, "Grandma, I am here." And she would say, "Yes, you're here." And she would have this amazing smile, like, you know, suddenly, I was here. And she loved me so much, and it makes her so happy to see that I was here again. So really, kind of really appreciative, she would really kind of be. And then as she got kind of older and her faculty started to weaken, then this stopped happening. I would come back, and she would look at me and find kind of like some kind of memory, but very faint. And she would smile, but very faint. But what was interesting was that when my niece came with a little rabbit, she wanted the rabbit to be next to her the whole time. And I think because the rabbit was the last thing she could connect to, because she was very isolated in her illness, in her weakening of her faculty, that she could still connect with this rabbit. I think this rabbit could still give her room. And that's why she kind of wanted it. And my niece would bring it specially for grandma so she can be next to it. And that there would be that home, there would be that love. And that's why I feel it's such an essential quality that in a way we need to really cultivate. In a way not to take it for granted, but to be careful to not associate, often we associate love with liking. I love somebody because I like them. This is, of course, often this happens for. But to me, it is not necessarily that I like somebody to love them. And that's what I realized living in community. For 16 years I lived in community. For 10 years in Korea as a man, and for 6 years in England. And what was interesting living with 10 other people that you do not necessarily share my, even if you're Buddhist, you might not have lots of similar perceptions and various things like this. And what I realized is that although I might not like somebody or might not get on with them, I still love them and care for them as human beings. Because they too are human beings. They too were grieving. And we were sharing the same experience. I think this is what is vital in love, that we do not love in the abstract. In order to be able to love, we have to share the life of the other. We have to be with the other to see their humanity, to see the quality in a way with ourselves, so that we can really have this care, this comfort, this appreciation of them, even if you don't see eye to eye. And it's very interesting when we have kind of like happen to have reunion with a community member, even if you do not get on with them, you say, oh yes, it's so nice to see you. And again, you feel very appreciative because you love this person, you've shared something with them. So in a way, looking at love, see, what would it mean, creative love? To me, creative love is a love which is not attached. But one has to be careful what it means not to be attached. Because recently I read this wonderful article in Tricycle magazine, it's a Buddhist magazine. And there's this small article about this woman and all her Buddhist boyfriends who were highly unattached and totally uninvolved and acted very unsatisfactory. And to me this is very interesting, how you can use this idea of non-attachment. Oh, I am not attached, but of course I want to have sex with you. This is a different matter, of course. But you know, I cannot love you because, you know, I cannot your tongue. But to me, this is not love. This is like saving us. Because when we know somebody, of course, we'll appreciate the person, we'll be connected with the person, we'll be influenced, nurtured, we'll depend in them, but not. Again, we're not fixing them, we're not fixing ourselves. Because often what we do is we do two different things. We attach. We grasp at the feeling that they create. This is interesting. Because if we're with somebody we really love, when we're there, we feel better, we feel well, we feel happy. So in a way, we grasp at this feeling. Oh, I am happy. I am happy when I am with them. So I want to be with them all the time. So then I am happy all the time. At the beginning of our marriage, we still not what I would do. I would stick to, you know, all the time. Eat vegetables, you know, follow you, you know, all the time. And you know, he has a little, I said, something crowded. And suddenly I said, wait a minute, this is not a good idea. Because what was interesting is when you do this, when you fix on the feeling and on the person who gives the feeling, is that actually you cannot develop or the relationship. And I think often we have this romantic idea of love as a merger of forces, to merge. But personally, I think it's like parallel lines. In between, you share something which can grow, but outside of the line, you also have other people. You can love, you can appreciate, you can care for, and you can develop. So love is not just for one person, but it's for so many different things. Nature, animals, family, friends, neighbors. I mean, it's endless. And anyway, that's where the beauty of love. It's endless. We can go on loving all kinds of different people. So in a way, kind of looking how can we cultivate that love? How can that love be in our life? How can it be a creative way of love? What would it mean for us? What would it mean in our various relationships? And also finally, to be careful not to equate love with falling in love. I think falling in love is a very specific state. It's like a meditative state. It happens and it goes. And it is not a continuous state. I think it's very important, because often I think we equate falling in love and all the tumult and excitement and, you know, kind of that, with loving the person. I think it's slightly different thing. It's a beginning of something, it builds, and then that, again, has to be transformed into something which is lived every day. I mean, we can try to fall in love every minute, but I think this is a little hard work. So it's easier just to love the person. How can I love someone? How can I accept them? How can they love me? How can they accept me? To me, this is very much, in a way, the gift of love is a gift of acceptance, of really seeing the person. And of course, that doesn't mean that we cannot talk and what is difficult. But I think, in a way, there is a gift of accepting that humanity, of being, in a way, a witness to the humanity of the other. And recently I had this experience in France with my niece. Time to time she comes and stay with my mother, which lives downstairs. We live in the same house, my mother lives downstairs. And then, at the beginning, my niece was a lot with grandma. And now she spends a lot of time with auntie and uncle. And anyway, we had just worked in the garden, we were a little tired, so we sat in the sofa in the living room, and we just stood and put some sugar on. And then the niece comes in, she's 5 years old, and she comes in and says, "Ah, I am going to dance." And we indicated that this was a fine thing to do, and we just sat there. And for the next 30 minutes, she just danced. I mean, it was not, no way else, but she danced. And the only thing we needed to do was to see her. That's all we needed to do. She would talk if we were looking. And we were looking. And just that, for 30 minutes, she did her thing. And it was a very special moment. For me, it was a very special moment of love, of seeing someone, of being with someone. And then she went. And then the next morning, she came again. And she wanted to put some music on. But no music was right. Because we could not recreate the moment. Because the conditions were different. So I would like to look a little at other feelings. Because today I said to try to be aware of feelings. And why? And I know it's a little difficult. When you sit in meditation and not much is happening, it seems a little difficult to be aware of feelings. It's kind of like a little something here, but it's nothing major. You know, it's just a little, kind of, it's very hard, you know, to describe it. It's just something moving a little faint here. But I think if we know that feeling, and if we can be with this feeling, just a faint, whatever it might be, but in a spacious way, then I think we are less frightened, less caught by feeling. Because I think, you know, feelings are totally natural. Again, it's like thought. You are feelings because you are human and you are able to have them. The meditation is not so that you start having feelings. No anger, no sadness, nothing. To me, this is not a human being, this is a robot. So, we have feelings, it's very normal, natural. But, the thing is, when the feeling becomes a disturbing emotion, this is in a way that movement. You have the feeling, and it can be hot and fiery, like anger. It can be heavy and dark, like a low mood. You can feel it like something is missing, like in jealousy. Each feeling, in a way, has a little texture. It has a little kind of something about it that we can recognize. And the feeling, can we just be with the feeling? I think to a meditator, this is a challenge. Can I be with the feeling as it is? And can I see how from the feeling which happened because of condition, then it becomes this disturbing emotion? And I remember going to one of these big things with the Dalai Lama, and you have him here recently, I heard. And this is one in an encampment in summer in France. It was really hot, it was kind of very sleepy, but never mind. And at the beginning of it, they had this peace occasion, and a little peace congress. So, you know, people came from various religions, and all talking about peace. And when you're going to talk about peace, it's all very peaceful, you know. So, and suddenly, among all these peace talk, comes this little guy, quite small, and he comes on the podium, and he says, "I am angry." I thought, "Ah, that's interesting." that kind of makes a difference in the rest of the, what's going on here. And actually, he's one of my heroes. I was really looking forward to seeing him. He was a Christian monk, Ladotier. And what he said was, I am angry at homelessness. I am angry at poverty. And I want to do something about it. So in a way, you can see that the feeling in itself is not bad. Because anger, for me, is energy. Anger is an energy which then the question is, can I use it constructively? And with Ladotier, he did. I mean, he created this amazing movement from the homeless. In fact, it's quite amazing what he created. But because, you know, he was angry at people dying on the streets, people living in poverty. So, again, one can see that the feeling itself is just a feeling. But the next is, what do we do? What are the story associated? What are the tendency? What do we do with it? I also used to work for a foundation for battered women. And one of the ladies I used to go with finally told me a story that, you know, she herself had been, you know, really hit and beaten by her husband, and it was, she managed to get out of it after going to hospital. And she was angry at women being beaten up. But that led her to do this work. So in a way, it was constructive. It was not destructive. So in a way, it's kind of like, how can we deal with feelings? How can we know feelings? How can we know what gives rise to them? And then all within our own body-mind complex, a condition, which then lets it become a disturbing emotion. Because it's true that anger can be very disturbing. Stephen used to be a prison tackle, Buddhist tackle. He used to go to see the prisoner for to talk about meditation and Buddhism. And it was a kind of relatively high security, so you had a lot of murderers and things like that, people like that. And he said, you know, you have these people who are very ordinary people. They're just like you and me. They're ordinary human beings. But the one problem they have is that they go upon certain conditions, they go into a rage, and then they kill somebody. And then they end up in jail, when they're otherwise quite friendly, kind, normal people, interested in meditation. And so in order to see that when it becomes a disturbing emotion, it can really take us over. And that's why I put so much emphasis on the stability that we try to develop in meditation. So that when we have these very strong feelings, to try to see what can we do, to me this is the main point, what can we do not to augment them? Or if we can diminish from that, at least not increase them. What is it that we do that increase the feeling? And you know, it's all the story. I am right. They're wrong. I am the truth. They've not got it. What is it? It is. But to see, and of course, often we can be angry because we're frustrated, we block, I mean, we can be tired, there can be many reasons. But I think it's interesting to know for ourselves, what is it that triggers it? And what is it that can help me to be more creative with it? Otherwise, you have also, as a feeling, as an interesting feeling, but which has a very different feel about it, is what I would call a low mood. Not depression as an illness, but in a way, some kind of, sometimes you feel kind of, you feel low, you feel a little useless, you feel a little grey, you feel a little dark, and you can recognize that feeling. And this feeling can arise because you are sad, because somebody died, or you can have it because you feel frustrated, you feel blocked. Or you can have it because you're ill, or you can have it because you have not slept for many days. I mean, there can be many reasons for this feeling to arise. But to see. But of course, when we sang, if somebody dies, we sang. I remember when in Korea, my teacher often was asked to give talks for funerals of people he knew. And he would give the talk, and to me it was always fascinating, but he would say, so-and-so has died, and there is birth, there is death, there is no birth, there is no death, and he would go into this kind of, you know, very kind of metaphorical kind of language. And then he would say that he died, and then he would cry for about 3 minutes, you know. And to keep it there, there is no birth, there is no death, there is... And to me what was interesting is that you could have a coexistence of this, you know, seeing this as a natural phenomenon, birth and death, and at the same time being sure, because he knew the fellow, and he was sad that the person had died. But he was not caught. He could have the feeling, he could express the feeling, and the feeling could pass. And then he could have a different feeling. But I think for us the difficulty is that when we have a low mood, we actually, it has the opposite effect of anger. Anger gives us energy. But a low mood actually depletes us. And it kind of, we go down and down and down. And that's why I think we need to have a little different way of being with this. To know it, and to be very careful that the low mood doesn't take us into a spiral which I would call the poor me. Poor me. Life is oppressed. I am oppressed. There is no hope. And it's very interesting how we can go very quickly from somebody else's death to poor me. We have this kind of like cycle within us. I don't know why. This poor me syndrome. But you know, we have to be very careful about it. Because when it happens, when we go into that spiral, when it is very, it really requires so much energy, which we don't have to go out of that. So please, you were careful. How can I deal with the feeling without thinking in it? And what is it that will help me not to be so caught in it? And once I saw that, once I woke up, and I felt, ooh, I felt good. But I couldn't see any reason for that. No reason whatsoever. But the feeling was there. So, okay. Next morning, fine. That took 15 days. But I did not do anything. I did not identify. I did not do it. I just thought, oh, this is there. That I would have a headache and things to have this feeling. It would be strange, but... And then what, in a way, I felt dissolved it was compassion. Having compassion for something which was quite urgent and intense, and I really listened to the person, and then the feeling was gone. So in a way, we cannot necessarily control our feeling. They arise, and we don't necessarily know sometimes why. But I think if we can learn to deal with them in a different way, to not fix them, then I think we can, in a way, deal with them alone, they will change. Because often something else will come. Or it was a time when I was feeling a little kind of low. And this was in winter in England, which is kind of very dark. So, you know, every old condition leads to feeling like that. And I said, And I thought, what can I do? What can I do in a way to help myself here? And I thought, let's go and do some wood carving. And so off I went, because there's some wood carving course. So I go on this wood carving course, and the first night I thought, at the end of the night, I thought, maybe this is not a good idea. I have pain everywhere in my body. But then I learned to be aware of the movement, and it really was very helpful. I never did wood carving again. I did it for 10 weeks. But really it was, in a way, the answer to being in that feeling in a different way, uplifting a little the whole being. So what I am saying is, how can we deal with our different feelings, and how can we creatively, in a way, engage all these different feelings. I forgot what I wanted to say today. How are you?
You're not obliged not to know. But what I'm trying to do, well, I totally agree that this is one of the capacity we have as human beings. We have the capacity, and it's some seed in the brain, and I could really see it with my grandmother that this went over time, that she saw the world in a different way. But there is, of course, we have this faculty in our brain to make sense of the world. So we generally describe the world to ourselves very immediately. You know, this is the sound of the wind, this is the sound of the dog, this is... But I think, if we... And this is just as an exercise in meditation. I am not saying to do this at home, necessarily. But as an exercise in meditation, I feel that we can actually listen to a sound and not necessarily describe it to ourselves immediately.
The sound is a
word. Yeah, of course. Of course, but it's kind of like you listen. So it's not that you totally deconstruct the experience. I am not asking you to totally deconstruct the experience. I am not doing a very bad here. But I am just trying in a very small way, to try to see, can you try, it's just an experiment, can you try to listen and to not describe over much what is it you experience? And in terms of the feeling, especially with the feeling, it's because my experience when I was listening to that machine breaking the concrete, I experienced that I could go inside the sound and not say I am listening to a machine. But I could really just go into the experience of the sound. And in the same way with feelings, when they're not too strong, I totally agree. It's a very strong, very hard not to say anger or whatever it is. But when they're relatively faint, to just try to, before you name them, this is this and this is this, because of that, to try to, what is it I feel as a sensation? And so to go inside the experience itself. In the same way that when you have a pain in the knee, instead of saying pain or knee, you go inside the experience. That's what I'm trying to describe. But yes, it is, you know, generally, we go toward the object, and it's an object, and it's not a sound or whatever. Of course, there is a direction, our consciousness. I mean, we're not unconscious. When I ask you to do the exercise, you're not unconscious. The consciousness recognizes, in general, the sound, the body, the sensation. But I'm trying for you to go closer to the experience before we start to describe it, and generally from that, to proliferate. That's what I'm trying to do, to kind of slightly break the link from contact to naming to proliferation.
Yes?
Finding creative ways, recognizing that it's going on, because I think this is what awareness does. Awareness enables us to see, this is what is going on. So you're not so caught in it, so identified. And now you can creatively, what can I do with this? How can I deal with that? And this is one way to do that. Thank you. Yes?
in not in the obsessive way, necessarily. And I kind of maybe talk a little bit differently, but what is it?
Mm-hmm.
But then I thought, well, it's just like a creative being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I know that different approaches, and I
thought, what do you want to do? No, of course. And tomorrow you might actually use what I present to do that, although it's not its main idea. Because tomorrow I will introduce the question, what is this? And generally when you do what is this, it's more to the whole moment. You're not describing, you're not putting into anything that is specific. What some people find interesting is when they have a thought, what is this? And then they enter a different relationship to it. So of course no. But I'm saying, you know, again, you have to, I'm giving instructions for you to explore that dimension. This is my main point. And then in a way you have to find ways which make sense to yourself. I think sometimes it's good to, in a way, remain with the feeling as it is. And sometimes I think it's good to ask, what is this feeling? What is going on? How is it? What am I telling myself? And to kind of, not to be in the past, but to be in the moment of the feeling and to go inside it with inquiry. Well, no, I think it can be also very useful. Okay, where am I?
What about love
and suffering? Tomorrow I will talk about compassion.
Okay.
And then I will talk about both sides. But no, in a way, because then it will be a much longer talk. But yes, to me, in a way, it goes both ways. That not all the time, but a lot of the time, if one really loves somebody, and then somebody else can love us. But in a way, I feel it's easier for me to talk about how I can love someone, and I think it is much more difficult to say how the other person should love me, but hopefully they can love me the same way I do. And I hope that my love to them.
When you're looking for a return, when you're doing something to not necessarily give you love back,
That's why personally I would say what is most essential is to start by loving oneself. Because if you love yourself, then you will not have what I would call this dependent relationship with the love of others. That, I mean, I could not go into it tonight, but another aspect is, as you say, that our existence, our identity depends on the love of the other person. When I think what is very essential is that our identity depends on our own confidence, love in ourselves. This is, of course, very essential. So I would say, yes, when I love somebody, you love in an open way. But what also I wanted to point out is that when one is loved, it really adds something. Even if you have no expectation of it, it really adds something to your own existence. I think it's very important to also say that yes, to love openly, I think, you know, that's what we ideally would want to cultivate. But at the same time, I think it's important to see how beneficial it is for us to love someone, but also for someone else to love us. But not that we depend on it for our existence.
It's only
self-conditioning. I hope that you can love in this way. That's all I can say. I hope you can do that. No, that's what I mean. I hope you can love the whole world in that way. I hope that you can love the Arab people, you can love the Jewish Orthodox, you can love Saddam Hussein, you can love God's voice in exactly the same way. I hope so for you. Yes, of course, it's a good idea. But personally, what I'm interested in is in the actuality of how are you with your neighbor. But I don't, you see, I don't understand. This is what I am saying. I'm saying there are different kinds of love, and that we need to cultivate them all. That would be an aunt, that would be a neighbor, that would be our enemy, that would be anybody in the world. There are so many different ways we can love. I don't think I'm saying anything different, but possibly you have an idea of a much more fantastic love, it's possible, and I wish that you can, of course that you can do that. And then, I'm sorry that this is the last one. You still want to ask your question? Of course, I mean, I think contact is important, but again, I think the main, I mean, I'll talk more about this tomorrow when I talk about compassion. I think, in a way, that would be in love, that would be in compassion. The first thing is that you have to recognize the other. You have to see the other. You have to, again, to go out of the self-centeredness and to meet the other, to have that relationship. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And actually, the team as a proof of love for you, if you go in the kitchen now, they have a little surprise for you. So, thank you very much.